Welcome to the Tactical Security Podcast.
Welcome to Tactical Security, where we argue cybersecurity practices from a technical and a managerial standpoint. Here's what you need to know about today's security tactics.
This is episode 4. During this episode, we're going to continue discussing the human attack surface.
We are with some stellar guests, but first up, I am Wolf. I'm an advisory CISO.
I'm Dave. I work in cybersecurity professionally, but you may know of my work with Hack for Kids.
And today we have guests. We have Miss Batts, Kimber, and Chris Krebs. Hey, welcome to Tactical Security.
Hey.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing great. You guys want to give a quick introduction to yourselves?
Sure. I'm Kimber Dowsett, Ms. Bat on Twitter. I'm a director at KSG now, but my views do not represent my employer. But sometimes they do because he's right beside me right now. I've been working in this space for about 15 years. I was recruited by Apple right out of grad school, and I've had an illustrious career in both the public and private sectors.
And I'm Chris Krebs, founder of the Krebs Park, the Krebs Stamos Group. Man, can't get that right. We're almost a year old. And I'm just crashing this party here. We were lucky enough to have Kimber join us almost a month ago now. And we're a small but growing consultancy. We're about, 23 employees. And we brought everybody in for holiday winter gathering, team building exercise. And as I saw someone named Kimber was getting ready to do a podcast, I decided I'd crash it for her.
Also, Chris was fired by tweet.
Yes. It's funny, Dave messaged me and I was talking with my wife and I'm like, hey, guess who I'm going to be talking to? You remember the guy who was fired by tweet? And she's like, yes, Chris Krebs. I'm like, absolutely. Absolutely.
He has the jacket to prove it now.
Cyber, yes. The Cyber Warcon crew gave me a nice little bomber jacket with a large fired by tweet on the back.
Yeah, nothing like our industry. I was going to say nothing like our industry to remind us of our highlights in our career.
Right.
You know, it's a good point. What I was most, like the brightest spot of all of this over the last year was just how the information security community, which I think gets a pretty bad rap for being fairly toxic and tearing each other down. It really rallied around the election security community, supported me. And I'll forever be thankful for that. And, you know, Kimber is just one of the many people that were a part of that.
You know, to that point, you know, being a president of a charity, I could tell you there is a lot more good that our industry does, whether it's IT or InfoSec, cybersecurity, whatever you want to label yourself as, than the negative. But just unfortunately, the negative rises to the top much more rapidly than all the good.
It's almost like the algorithms in the social media platforms that we all use incentivize that sort of negative engagement.
You know, you might be onto something. So we know you have a limited time, and we want to kind of really get to one of the main questions that we have for you, Chris, and then we're going to take the rest of the time to speak with Ms. Batt. So, Wolf, you want to fire away?
Yeah, so in this season of tactical security, we've been really looking at the human attack surface, how to harden it, how to work with people, how to build culture, various exploits. And Chris, when I heard you're joining, one of the things I was just itching to ask is, what do you think about disinformation and combating disinformation, right? All the different ways that people can be mentally exploited. What are some of the things you've learned recently about ways that goes wrong, and even better ways that that we can help and be a positive force?
So it's a really timely question. I worked with the Aspen Institute and the Commission on Information Disorder released a final report a couple weeks ago that laid out some recommendations for the social media platforms that they could take to counter disinfo, the government can take, that civil society can take, the media organizations take. And really the takeaway there is that there's no single organization that owns the space. And it's really going to have to be, as cheesy as it sounds, one of those whole society things are really where it comes down, particularly for threats to democracy, is do we want to continue to be a democracy? And if the answer is yes, then it's going to take all of us within the democracy to take certain proactive steps going forward. Now, the biggest challenge here is that we in the cybersecurity community, the InfoSec community, tend to look at things from a technical perspective. It's the devices we use, the controls we put in place. But if you think about our adversaries, they actually blend their tactics together. So the Russians, as a part of their strategy, think about information technical and information psychological. And they use tactics within those two disciplines in concert to achieve their objectives. And so as defenders, we need to be thinking about, okay, I can lock down a system as comprehensively as I can from a technical perspective. But, you know, kind of like with the ubiquity claims the other day, whether they're true or not, you know, the bad guys, ransomware or state actors, they can exploit a human vulnerability and bribe someone to get access into the network using that USB key as the air gap jump. And so, you know, again, the thing here is that the brain is as vulnerable as anything, and you may see activity that you can't explain. And so you jump to these conclusions that seem to be fantastical. And that's, in fact, what we saw in the 2020 election, where, yes, we had made significant improving the security of our systems. And all it took was somebody to come in over the top and say, yeah, but. And that's what's really kind of permeated the system. And it's so hard to, you know, disprove the negative. And so we need to do more awareness building on the front end, which is, again, something I just cringe saying, but it's true. We have to raise awareness and educate people on how these complex systems work and the controls and layer defenses that are in place.
So, you know, one of the things that you said there and that it kind of jumped out at me was about, you know, attacking the brain. Right, whenever we talk about security, and I'm going to quote Jeff Mann, it's people, processes, and technology. And, you know, the people's the brain, right? And the technology you could patch, the process you can update. But when you talk about how do you patch the brain, you mentioned it. You've got to raise awareness. You've got to educate. You got to train. And it needs to be constant until you know that CVSS score goes from critical to low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As I think about this info, at least, I do see it as a supply and demand problem. And from a technical perspective, we can solve all the supply side issues with social media platforms, trusted news sources, whatever trusted news sources are. But you know, let's just say hypothetically, we solve all that. There's still on the demand side, people want this stuff. They when they can't explain something, they jump to conclusions, or there are just some folks that live in a space where tribalism dominates. And so that is part of the solutions we looked at, some of the solutions we looked at in the Aspen work. But how do we rebuild that sense of community? And my theory is that fracturing and fragmentation of communities has gotten worse during COVID because we had to kind of withdraw from kids' sports events, from the philanthropies that you're talking about. We've got to get back to those lowest common denominator connection points to build community and push back on some of the fear mongering and conspiracy theorists that are running rampant right now.
Yeah, and short of those community events being out and about, it's really easy online to fall into these echo chambers, right?
Yeah.
It's really easy to go, well, everyone, I'll give you an example. I was recently talking to a family member who said, you know, aren't you concerned because everyone keeps saying that COVID was manufactured in a lab? And I was like, who's everyone in this context? But that was their social media. That's what they kept hearing. So I wonder if you've got any ideas, because obviously getting people out and networking and meeting face-to-face and out of their echo chambers is one. But do you have any ideas on how to create a counter narrative or to work with folks when you're saying something that goes completely against what all the algorithms are feeding them day in and day out?
You know, honestly, I don't believe that you can effectively counter disinfo with accurate information. It's not a one-to-one, right? That's part of the advantage of disinformation and influence operations is that there's an asymmetric advantage. And, you know, Garry Kasparov calls it the flood of lies. Steve Bannon calls it the flood of something else that starts with an S. I'm trying to keep things PG here. And that's their advantage. They're not seeking to convince you of anything. What they're seeking to do is destabilize and undermine confidence, and where they can exploit the vulnerability of the human mind and have you lose focus. And so I think that goes to the front end of getting out there and providing more baseline information and more transparency. And, you know, you mentioned that COVID may have been created in a lab. And that's actually within the realm of possibility. Even the US intelligence community concluded that it's a possibility. And so we can't, for the sake of media and counter narratives and political fact-checking, dismiss these things. And that's in part what happened last year, I think. And you know, we've got to be much more transparent in how we communicate about these things. Then there were a number of missteps, both on COVID itself, masking, vaccines last year, that I think there are a number of lessons learned on that front.
If I can add to one of those reasons that countering disinformation with truth isn't going to be as effective as well, is because by the time there's a known need to counter the disinformation, like Pandora's out of the box, right? Like, and the disinformation that's out there, these folks, for the most part, the ones that are going viral, they sprinkle just enough bit of truth into the entire disinformation campaign that it's easier.
There's a patina of truth, right?
Right. Like, yeah. there's just a little something that passes a sniff test. So then, you know, the rest of it becomes gospel. And then, so when you counter it with the truth, that just, it's easy to perceive that as the disinformation, right? Like it.
So one of the things I really think we need to do a better job of is exposing those that are, you know, seeking to use disinformation, particularly for financial gain. And that's what a lot of this stuff is lately with COVID and even the election 2020 stuff. It's people are just grifting, right? They're fundraising for various things. And one thing humans hate is being gamed, right? Being conned. So right. I think the more that some of the authorities can expose some of the fraudulent aspects of disinformation and selling things, then that will, I think, tamp down on, get some controls around some of the bad actors these days.
But even tactically, right? Tactically, if your game is to start with decrediting your adversary by saying whatever they say is going to be a lie, everything that they say is infactual, everything I say is factual, then even if it's not, you've already kind of gained their confidence, right? So it's really a confidence game as well.
Yeah. Well, but that plays actually into the defender's advantage too. So one of the things that we had for the 2020 election was the ability to game plan red team scenario, you know, game out a number of different scenarios. We had 3 years. And so we anticipated virtually everything that happened, and we were able to pre-bunk, right? We were saying, look, this is the time, this 1 month window before the election, this 2 week window after the election, that's when adversaries are going to make certain claims like this, that, and the other. And a lot of that happened. The Iranians tried to push certain narratives that we had, you know, kind of preconditioned the environment. Now, our problem was at CISA is that we were a lone voice in the dark, right? You know, we didn't have the reach or the visibility or understanding. So we have to have that coalition of pro-democracy forces that can help promote awareness about what's going on. And part of this is, in fact, just more education on how elections actually work. Most people don't actually fully understand that it's not just you show up on a Tuesday in November and then wait for CNN to post results that night. It's obviously a much more complicated process with constitutional and legal controls.
If I may, I have this truth philosophy. I learned it when I was probably in college, and it's stuck with me since then. And it sounds obvious when you hear it, but it really sums up pretty much like everything that you're saying about DISO in like a couple sentences. So here it is. Brace yourself. The truth in its entirety is truth, but any fraction of the truth is fallacy.
Yeah. And look, that's what politicians do really well, right? They cherry pick elements of the truth for their own benefit. And look, I mean, I think back to a lot of the mask hesitancy or anti-masking right now, you can pinpoint back to the spring of 2020 when US government officials said, you don't need masks. And what they were doing, in fact, was protecting the supply chain for frontline workers. If they had just said, look, in the meantime, use a bandana, what we're trying to do is preserve supply chain for hospital, you know, workers and frontline employees, we will make sure the supply chain catches up. But they didn't do that. They were, you know, too cute by half. And look at the erosion in confidence as a result. Right. Now, I'm not saying that's entirely, you know, at fault here, but I think there's some evidence that suggests that that's a good part of it right now. That those are the facts they use, the anti-maskers use to promote their side of the argument.
I think that example, in combination with what you're saying about election security, if you kind of abstract a broader set of principles from that, you know, anything in this world today is incredibly complicated. And all of us are operating our own simplified mental model just to get through the day. And because of that, it's very easy to get partial information or conflicting information from the people who understand what's going on with the more complex system. Because as a guardian of the truth, as a guardian of the person who understands, in your case, that how the election system works, you know, you're trying to simplify the message as much as possible. But in doing so, I imagine, you know, the fidelity gets lost. So how do you bridge that gap between raising some awareness of the complexity without having a message that's so complex it gets lost?
There's what's so different about today? Because propaganda and fake news, or whatever you want to call it, has been a thing since the beginning of human history. And it's accelerated at certain points in human history, like the Gutenberg press, the mimeograph, the radio, TV, fax machine. What's obviously so different now is the internet and social media platforms and just the breadth and velocity of information. And you're not, you know, no one in this, as Wayne Gibson would call it, the unthinkable complexity. No one in this ecosystem could possibly hope to counter everything. So you got to pick your battles. And, you know, at least the things that I've chosen right now are, you know, in support of democracy and public health and equality, you know, marginalized communities. That's what we focused on in the Aspen Commission. So, you know, I've obviously got a particular bent towards democracy and elections. And so you pick your battles. You let others that specialize in other areas pick theirs, and you just go to work and you take the time that you have in front of you and use it smartly and effectively.
You're here.
All right. Well, I'm going to hand the reins back over here to Kimber, but thanks for having me on, and till next time.
Hey, Chris.
Thanks for joining us, Chris.
So much. Yeah, sorry, Wolf and I talking over each other. Thank you so much for joining us, and Kimber, thank you so much for dragging Chris in. We really appreciate it.
All right, Kimber, kill him.
Take care. Happy holidays.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
All right.
Okay. Now he's gone. We can talk about him.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That guy. So kind of getting on to the usual topic for this season on tactical security. We do have other questions that we want to ask you specifically, Ms. Bad. And, you know, Wolf and I, we kind of just shoot from the hip with this, we sent you some of those in advance, but, you know, we've been talking primarily about disinformation, and we know that the human attack surface is absolutely exploited from all different angles and vectors. But let's kind of maybe step back for a second for just some folks who don't know who you are. Do you mind taking a minute and just telling us what you or how you define the human attack surface?
Sure. So when I think about human attack surface, I'm not thinking about just vulnerable humans who are, you know, victims of phishing attacks or ransomware or things like that. I kind of look at it as the sum of all the exploitable security holes or gaps that humans within your organization could create. So I look at it a little more broadly. So the human piece around social engineering is certainly part of it. But like Chris mentioned, we've also got to look at the human attack surface as a human taking a bribe, right? To jump an air-gap network. So I don't know, did that answer your question?
It's really more for us to understand your definition of the human attack.
Oh, okay.
So that's fine. Yeah. It's not really the industry defines it.
Yeah. I think it's just a broad spectrum. And I think too many times the InfoSec profession in general, it is a gross generalization, right? But I think too often the knee jerk is, you know, user mistakes, dumb users. Oh, we hate the users, you know, and a lot of it is, you know, a lot of what we see is not your average non-technical sort of user who is susceptible to a phishing attack. Like, it's a misconfiguration that a very technical person made in a, you know, when setting up like a cloud infrastructure environment, for example.
Precisely.
Yeah, so that's kind of, I'm not a blame the user person for sure.
Yeah, as we're recording this, I'm just back from presenting at DevOps Days Tel Aviv, where I was covering, you know, the security aspect of DevOps. And you're spot on. I mean, these are some incredibly technical, incredibly well-intentioned, incredibly trained and disciplined people who through incentives, through, you know, where they're focused on, through making a simple mistake, through a number of different reasons, can, of course, create a whole bunch of vulnerabilities by leaving stuff open on the internet or whatnot. So I like that point. I think it's always incredibly timely to remind folks that we are dealing with some intelligent people and that we need to help give them information, which is one of the reasons why I was asking Chris some of the questions that I was asking him, because I know it's very difficult to get the right information to the right person at the right time. Mm-hmm. Do you have any guidance on that side? What have you seen that's worked?
So what's interesting here, where I'm at now with KSG, is we have researchers, you know, on staff who are giving leadership daily briefings on where they're seeing the threats coming from, what's the latest CVE that dropped, are there common misconfigurations that are causing, you know, enormous headaches for organizations, not just from like our perspective for, you know, making sure our own systems are secure, but also like, oh, is that a company we should reach out to see if they need our help, right? but as far as, you know, the average organization, I mean, there's not really any account, you know, any accounting, like, how would I say it? You've got to be watching the trends. Somebody's got to keep an eye on the news. Somebody's got to keep an eye on the alerts. I spend the first half hour of my day, like, checking the news, checking the feeds, even, you know, help me, but I even check the LinkedIn feeds because people are really good about, you know, posting articles about, you know, things like misconfigurations or known issues with access control systems, things like that. So like you said, Wolf, it's not just that non-technical user at their desk anymore. Like, these are some of these big breaches that we've seen over this last year, and this last year has been ripe with some of the biggest botches we've seen in a long time as a security community. I think when you pull the thread, it traces back to a very technical person who, yep, just made a simple mistake or didn't push a patch because they didn't realize, you know, how incredibly bad the vulnerability was. It's so hard. I think you have to do your homework. And if your organization has the luxury of having someone who can pop in and do homework for everyone and send it out in the morning briefing, like, great. But I know we're not all, you know, we're not all that fortunate. I wish I had a better answer for you. I think if we could figure that out, we'd be in good shape though, right?
I think you actually make a great point, though, because there are some tools out there, I think like Recorded Future or something like that is one of those tools that aggregate information, sums it up and presents it as a daily email. But you're saying the IT directors or whomever spend some of that time, invest in self-education on current events, and then disseminate to the team, right? You don't want 15 people doing the same exact thing when one person can do it and everybody can learn from that person's time and benefit from that person's time. So I think there's a lot of value in that, right? And because this audience for tactical security is really focused to the folks that are not working in the security industry, and they're always looking for practices and processes and things like that to bolster and improve what they're doing so that they have the awareness and then they could know what actions to take. So I think you made a really good point.
The other interesting thing you said there, Kimber, was the daily briefing. I've got a couple daily briefing emails that without fail I'll read because it's incredibly hard to stay up on everything and to keep abreast of everything. So I've got a couple, you know, key resources that I rely on that it hits my inbox. It's like, oh, here's what's going on. So for example, this morning I was looking at, I was reading a briefing about the new rules around trains, which was interesting to me because I like trains and I recently rode on a train. So I was like, ah, good. Security is now considering the train side of things as one example. So I like that idea of a regular briefing. I'm still hung up on this idea of the briefing has to be high level enough to get me what I need to know right now. But knowing that the delta between that high level and the very specific understanding is usually where I feel we're at risk of being exploited, right? The delta between the high level and the actual reality. Yeah. But you can't know everything. So how do you pick your battles in that?
Well, and you know, what you just said kind of leads to the problem with the daily briefing, right? Alert fatigue. So when there's too much coming at you at once, then nothing's coming at you anymore, right? It's just a filter that right to the trash. I think you've got to be selective about your sources. Narrow your feeds to the things that are going to be most relevant to your organization. Like if you know your whole infrastructure is AWS, then you probably don't need to, you know, have somebody going deep in the weeds to read everything that's coming out of Azure, right? Or GCP. But some of that stuff is configuration and it's going to be like cloud agnostic, right? Or provider agnostic. So it's a good question, Wolf. And I think, at least for me, what I do is I have a few folks or a few organizations who I know when they post, it's going to be relevant to the things I'm interested in. And those are the places I start in the morning, you know, spending a little time on the front end or, you know, to figure out, I guess they'd be spending time on the back end, right? But figure out which feeds seem to work best for you and start there. For organizations who aren't doing any kind of, you know, just morning catch up, anything, even if they just pick one publication they're reading, that's still going to give them more information than they've had before. And sometimes just getting information kind of lets you know what you don't know. And it's easier to fall down these rabbit holes to find these other places where, you know, people are sharing out information. I think there's a old school kind of IT mentality. And we all know that, you know, old school InfoSec folks, most of us have our roots in, you know, IT. Back in the day, the way to keep your job was to not share information, right? You wanted to be the person who knew where all the bodies were buried. You had the keys to all the offices. You were the only one with the password to the server. And there just wasn't a lot of sharing. And that did not serve us well. And so I think the best thing that we can do now as a security community is make sure that when we're, you know, finding this stuff, finding good feeds, you know, really getting a value out of a daily briefing, or even I get some particular vendors emails a couple times a week with briefings, and they're usually pretty darn helpful. So we have to share that information out. You know, I don't think that, you know, Dave needs to spend his time tweeting out about every single thing that an organization needs to like look for and patch. But I think if Dave found a really helpful feed that was doing it, he could just share out the feed and say, hey, this might have value to your org.
That sounds good. Well, you know, you've actually kind of really started answering our last question before we have to wrap up. We only have a few more minutes left. And you've given the listeners a lot of different call to actions and tactics and things that they can do, which is fantastic. But if there was one tactic you would want our listeners to walk away from this podcast with regarding the Human Attack Service and cybersecurity, what would it be?
A couple things. So for one, I think when we're talking about Human Attack Service, we need to like standardize what that really means. And, you know, my definition's the right one. So that space where a human could create the hole in the org. So that's not just phishing or social engineering. That could be insider threat, configuration, errors, the ability to be bribed, not being well informed. And that's not necessarily a non-technical user. I'm talking about like a super technical user who's still not really up to date on best practices. So, you know, expanding how maybe the security community is viewing what the term means would give organizations a better idea of what that whole attack surface looks like. I think phishing engagements are fine. I think social engineering engagements are fine. I think those tabletops are fine, but they're only a small part of all the problems that can happen in layer eight. So, on a tactical level, like documentation, right? Make sure your playbooks are updated. You've got good instruction, good guidance, best practices within your organization. I think if you've got a whole bunch of people looking at the same documentation and contributing and, you know, filling in gaps, that's kind of the best thing you could do inside your org. Yeah, write it all down. And oh my gosh, you know, automate yourselves out of a job, right? Like automation, we need to take the human out of the access control piece, right? And have that all be, you know, automated in the onboarding and offboarding processes. Offboarding is like the single biggest place I've seen orgs flub because they don't have, you know, an automated system. They've just got a checklist somewhere. But if you've got, you know, unfortunately an adversarial employee, they could exfiltrate, you know, all kinds of things in that hour between when they're let go and when IT kills their access, right? So I think those are just sort of some tactical approaches.
So just to summarize that, having a comprehensive definition of your human attack surface, have responses documented and automated wherever possible, and bring that together to reduce your risk. That's what I heard. And Kimber, this has been so fantastic joining us. Again, thanks for Chris Krebs for him jumping in as well. I really appreciate it. To the listener, this has been Tactical Security with Dave and Wolf. I hope you'll join us for future episodes where we will continue to practices.
Stay healthy, everyone. Question truth and be better.